Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show where we really try to unearth the most important nuggets of knowledge from, well, often a whole stack of sources, research, and insights. Mm-hmm. Today, we're plunging into the sparkling, maybe sometimes bewildering world of Signet Jewelers Limited, ticker symbol SIG.
Sig, right.
You know them, K Jewelers, Zales, Jared. I mean, this isn't just about pretty rings and necklaces. It's really about trying to understand the complex dynamics of the world's largest retailer of diamond jewelry.
Yeah, it really is a giant.
A giant with, what, approximately 2,600 stores
mm-hmm.
and annual sales hitting close to $6.7 billion.
That's absolutely right. Our mission today really is to pull out the crucial insights from this pretty in-depth investment analysis we've got on Signet Jewelers.
Okay.
This company is, I mean, it's really in the thick of a massive transformation right now. They're actively shifting towards what they call connected commerce.
Connected commerce, okay.
But, and this is the key thing, they're trying this huge pivot against some really powerful industry headwinds. You've got rapidly changing consumer preferences, especially, you know, among younger generations.
Right. Millennials, Gen Z.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then there are just the broader macroeconomic pressures everyone's feeling.
So the big question we're kind of wrestling with today is this. Is Signet Jewelers a deep value opportunity? You know, a diamond in the rough, maybe, waiting to be polished.
Mm.
Or is it actually a classic value trap, something that looks shiny on the surface but might be hiding some pretty serious structural cracks underneath?
That's the dilemma.
The picture here is anything but simple, right? And we're going to try and unpack exactly why this whole debate is so compelling.
Okay, so let's start by just appreciating Signet's sheer scale. This isn't just, you know, another big jewelry chain. It is really the undisputed titan of the diamond jewelry world. In the U.S. alone, Signet commands an estimated market share somewhere between 9.6% and 10%.
10% of the U.S. market. Wow.
Yeah. And to put that into perspective, that's reportedly three times larger than its closest competitor.
Three times.
I mean, that level of market dominance is exceptionally rare in pretty much any retail sector, let alone one as traditionally fragmented as jewelry.
That's truly remarkable. So what kind of tangible advantages does that scale actually give them? I mean, I imagine it translates into some pretty significant competitive edges.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge strategic asset. This immense scale gives them crucial advantages that, you know, smaller competitors just can't replicate.
Like what specifically?
Well, primarily, it's about sourcing power.
Yeah.
Just imagine the leverage they have with diamond suppliers and manufacturers all over the world.
Right. They buy in bulk.
Exactly. Yep. And that translates into better pricing, more consistent quality, maybe even preferential access to the really desirable stones.
Okay.
Secondly, on the marketing front, their budget allows for these big national campaigns across multiple brands. That builds broad awareness and fosters trust on a level that, you know, independent shops can only dream of.
Yeah, you see their ads everywhere during the holidays.
Precisely. And then, of course, the sheer brand recognition of names like Kay and Zales is just invaluable for attracting and retaining customers. It's a built-in advantage that new entrants really struggle to establish.
Speaking of those names, Kay and Zales. Signet isn't just one single brand, right? It's more like a constellation of them. They use this multi-banner strategy.
That's right.
How do all these different brands fit together, and who are they trying to reach with each one? It seems complicated.
It is, but it's quite strategic. Their extensive portfolio is really designed to cover roughly 80% of the mid-market jewelry buyer base. They consciously avoid that sort of ultra-luxury segment, you know, the Tiffany's and Cartier.
Right. They're not playing there.
No. They focus on broader accessibility. So at the core, you have Kay Jewelers and Zales.
The mall brands.
Exactly. Those are the mall-based staples. Widely recognized, accessible diamond jewelry, particularly strong in the bridal category. That's key. Zales is generally positioned as slightly more affordable than Kay, which broadens its appeal to, you know, a wider demographic.
Okay, so those are the everyday, accessible, often mall-based brands. What about for people looking for something maybe a bit more upscale or just a different shopping experience altogether?
Right, that's where their accessible luxury banners come in. Jared, the Gallery of Jewelry is the prime example there.
Jared, okay.
It's designed as a larger, usually off-mall destination store. It offers a much broader selection. Think loose diamonds, custom design services, on-site repairs. Signet's actually working quite actively to modernize the whole Jared experience for a new generation.
Modernize how?
Updating store design, enhancing the digital integration, maybe tweaking the merchandise mix to appeal to younger tastes. Similarly, Diamonds Direct, which was another strategic acquisition.
Right, I remember that.
It follows a comparable off-mall destination-style model. It emphasizes a more curated and personal shopping experience.
And, of course, you can't ignore the massive shift towards online shopping. They've made some big moves into the digital-first space, too, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. Crucial moves. The acquisitions of JamesAllen.com back in 2017 and then Blue Nile more recently in 2022 were pivotal.
Blue Nile, yeah, we'll come back to that one, I suspect.
You will. These digital-first banners are designed specifically to cater to that younger, digitally native consumer. The kind of person who values, you know, huge selection, transparent pricing, lots of educational resources, all accessible from their phone or laptop.
Makes sense. They had to compete online.
It was a clear and, frankly, necessary acknowledgement that the future of retail had this significant growing online component. They couldn't afford to miss out.
And I think I read they even have some interesting sort of niche plays too, like mall kiosks doing piercing.
Indeed. Rounding out the portfolio are what they call their niche and growth banners. Banters by Piercing Pagoda operates through these mall kiosks. They specialize in ear piercing and affordable, kind of trend-driven fashion jewelry. Really targets a younger, very trend-conscious demographic.
Okay.
Then there's Rocksbox, which is a jewelry rental subscription service.
Oh, interesting. Like Rent the Runway for jewelry.
Sort of, yeah. It offers a lower commitment entry point into their whole brand ecosystem. It's a way to engage with consumers who maybe aren't ready for a big high-ticket purchase yet or just like to experiment with different styles frequently.
That's clever. This all sounds like a very comprehensive sort of multi-pronged approach. But I'm curious about the strategic shift they're talking about called Grow Brand Love. What does that actually mean? And does having so many brands under one roof create its own internal challenges? Like, do they end up competing with themselves?
That's a really insightful question. The Grow Brand Love initiative, it aims to go beyond just managing a portfolio of separate banners. The idea is to cultivate deeper, more emotional connections with each specific brand.
Okay.
Fostering unique value propositions that really resonate with specific customer segments. However, and this is where it gets fascinatingly complex, this strategy introduces a potential problem without truly clear and compelling differentiation between these brands.
Especially online.
Especially online, yes, where price comparisons are just instant. Signet risks competing directly with itself.
So you're talking about strategic cannibalization, where like K.com might be directly fighting with BlueNile.com for the exact same customer looking for, say, a lab-grown diamond ring, and that forces Signet into an internal price war.
That is the absolute core concern. If a consumer could find very similar, maybe even identical products across multiple Signet-owned websites or even between their physical stores and online, well, it can seriously erode Signet's own pricing power and their margins.
Oh.
Yeah. The success of this whole Grow Brand Love thing really hinges on their ability to create such distinct identities and value propositions that these brands genuinely complement each other rather than just fighting each other for the same customer's wallet. It's a very tricky tightrope to walk.
Definitely sounds like it. Let's shift gears slightly and talk about the operational structure of this empire. How is Signet actually organized geographically? And how does this whole connected commerce idea weave through it all?
Right. So Signet reports its business across three main segments: North America, International, and then this category called Other.
Okay.
North America is, without a doubt, the cornerstone. It represents the vast majority of their revenue and operating profit. It includes all those brands we just discussed across the U.S. and Canada. Their physical footprint there is immense, roughly 2,600 stores in total, and about 84% of those are in the U.S.
Huge presence. What about international?
The international segment is significantly smaller. It primarily covers the U.K. and Ireland with brands like H. Samuel and Ernest Jones names. Mm-hmm. They're well known over there.
All right. This segment has faced some pretty substantial headwinds recently due to macroeconomic volatility, things like labor strikes, currency fluctuations. That actually contributed to a noticeable sales decline in recent quarters for that part of the business.
Okay, so North America is the engine. International is smaller and facing challenges. What's in the other segment? Sounds a bit like a catch-all.
It kind of is, but it's strategically interesting. The other segment includes subsidiaries involved in rough diamond purchasing and then their conversion into polished stones.
Ah, so some vertical integration.
Exactly. It gives Signet a degree of vertical integration in its supply chain. Now, it's not a major revenue driver in itself, but it offers some important strategic benefits. Things like preferred relationships with diamond mines, they have a liaison office in India, And even their own diamond polishing factory in Botswana.
Really? A factory in Botswana?
Yeah. So this integration helps with sourcing reliability and potentially gives them a valuable cost advantage, especially in what can be a pretty volatile commodity market for diamonds. Interesting. So back to this connected commerce initiative, it sounds like it's designed to kind of knit all these disparate parts, the stores, the websites, the different brands together into one seamless experience for the customer. That sounds like a massive undertaking.
It is. It's absolutely their core strategic initiative right now. The goal is to seamlessly integrate that extensive physical store network with their robust digital platforms, and crucially, to leverage their physical footprint as a key competitive advantage.
How so? What can stores do that online-only players can't?
Well, think about it. Online-only competitors simply can't offer the convenience of, say, in-store pickup for an online order, or on-site repairs, or, importantly, those personalized consultations with actual jewelry experts.
Right, the human touch.
Precisely. These services drive foot traffic back into the stores, even for purchases that might have started online. It creates this powerful synergy between the online and offline channels that pure-play e-commerce retailers just can't replicate.
And it seems like this digital transformation push has actually delivered some pretty impressive sales figures for them, hasn't it?
It certainly has, especially looking back a couple of years. In fiscal 2022, their e-commerce sales reached a remarkable $1.5 billion.
Wow.
Which represented a staggering 101.4% increase compared to their pre-pandemic levels in fiscal 2020.
That's huge growth.
It really is. It clearly demonstrates that consumers are increasingly comfortable buying even fine jewelry online.
Yeah.
And that Signet's substantial investments in their digital infrastructure have indeed borne fruit. It shows they had some foresight in this area.
But at the same time, they're doing a lot of shuffling with their physical stores, closing some mall locations, opening others off mall. That sounds like a long, probably expensive, and frankly quite challenging process, especially with the whole ongoing decline of traditional mall traffic.
It is a profound strategic challenge, no doubt about it. They're actively optimizing their real estate portfolio because they recognize that secular decline in foot traffic at many traditional malls isn't reversing.
Right. People just don't go to malls like they used to.
Exactly. So systematically closing underperforming mall stores and opening these new, hopefully more profitable off-mall formats is critical for adapting to modern retail patterns and improving overall profitability. The concern here, though, is just how costly and complex this long-term process truly is.
Yeah.
Especially when you're battling that persistent secular decline in mall traffic. It's not a one-off fix. It's a continuous multi-year investment against a very powerful and established trend.
And speaking of challenges, this brings us right to a really significant concern for investors, that Blue Nile impairment. This wasn't just some minor accounting adjustment, was it? What does an impairment of this size, especially coming relatively soon after the acquisition, really signify about Signet capital allocation choices and maybe their strategic execution?
This is a critical point, and yeah, it's raised a lot of eyebrows. Signet recently recorded substantial non-cash impairment charges,
right,
primarily related to Blue Nile, their big digital acquisition.
How substantial?
In fiscal 2025, these charges hit a staggering $369.2 million.
Oof.
Yeah. And an impairment, just for listeners who might not be familiar, basically means the company has determined that the carrying value of an asset on its books, what they thought it was worth, is now greater than its recoverable amount, what they think they can actually get from it.
So they overpaid or messed up the integration?
In this specific case, it was attributed to a slower than anticipated recovery. But yes, that's the essence of it. An impairment of this magnitude, relatively soon after buying the company, sends a loud, very expensive signal.
It certainly does.
It strongly suggests that either the initial purchase price for Blue Nile is too high, or the integration process has been far more difficult and less fruitful than they expected, or maybe management fundamentally misjudged the intensity of competition and the true growth path for these digital jewelry assets.
So it casts doubt on their M&A strategy.
It absolutely raises material questions about the effectiveness of their capital allocation strategy and, critically, their ability to successfully integrate and operate these crucial digital businesses. It's a really stark reminder that even the largest players can make strategic missteps with very significant financial consequences.
Okay, so we've explored Signet's vast empire, the brands, the operations. But no company exists in a vacuum, right? The broader jewelry market is huge, and it seems like it's undergoing some pretty significant shifts itself. What does the overall market look like today in terms of size and growth?
Yeah, the context is key. The global jewelry market is indeed immense. Estimates for 2024 range quite widely, actually anywhere from $233 billion up to a substantial $475 billion globally.
That's a big range.
It is. Depends on what you include. But forecasts generally project compound annual growth rates, or CDRs, somewhere between 4.1% and maybe 8.7% over the next decade. Mm-hmm. So indicating pretty robust expansion overall.
And specifically in the U.S., where Signet is most dominant.
Focusing on the U.S. market, which is definitely Signet's primary stomping ground, it was valued at approximately $76 billion in 2024. The expected growth there is a bit more modest, with a projected CAGR around 4.1%. Still growth, but maybe not as fast as some global forecasts.
And you mentioned earlier, it's still a very fragmented market, lots of independent shops out there. That actually seems like a big opportunity for a giant like Signet, doesn't it?
It absolutely is. A defining characteristic of this industry historically and still today is its fragmentation. You have thousands of small independent jewelers operating alongside just a few large players like Signet.
So Signet can consolidate.
Precisely. This structure presents a significant long-term opportunity for a scaled operator like Signet. Given their unparalleled size and resources, they're uniquely positioned to consolidate the market and gain share from these smaller, maybe less resilient competitors who might struggle with things like marketing, technology investment, or complex supply chain management.
Okay, so even with all the talk about digital transformation and Blue Nile, people still seem to prefer buying high-value jewelry in person. Is that generally accurate?
That's still largely correct, yes. Despite the rapid growth of e-commerce, physical retail remains the dominant sales channel. It accounts for approximately 84% of total jewelry sales currently.
84%. Still.
Still. Especially for those high-value, emotionally significant purchases. Think engagement rings, major anniversary gifts. Consumers often still really value the ability to physically inspect the product, get that personalized service, and just kind of experience the moment in a store.
Makes sense for a big purchase.
It does. However, the online channel is undeniably growing much faster. It's projected to grow at a CAGR of about 7.9%. That's driven by increasing internet use, mobile shopping, and just evolving consumer preferences, particularly among those younger demographics we talked about.
So that really highlights the importance of their connected commerce strategy again, right? They need to be great both online and offline.
Exactly. They have to excel in both realms. They can't afford to neglect either one.
That makes intuitive sense. But jewelry is also fundamentally a luxury. It's a highly discretionary purchase. How does that inherent nature make Signet vulnerable to broader economic swings and shifts in consumer mood?
Yeah, this is a core characteristic. Jewelry is inherently sensitive to the broader economic cycle, precisely because it's a highly discretionary product category.
People cut back on it when times get tough.
Exactly. Consumer spending on luxury items is very closely tied to things like disposable income levels, consumer confidence indices, overall economic health. We saw this recently. The data from Bank of America, for instance, show that U.S. luxury spending per household had actually declined year over year for 10 consecutive quarters through 2024.
10 quarters of decline? Wow.
Yeah, only very recently showing signs it might be bottoming out. This clearly indicates a challenging, high-pressure environment for luxury retailers, and Signet is right in the middle of that.
And then there's this bigger, maybe more profound trend people talk about now, the experience economy. You know, people aren't just buying stuff anymore. They're buying experiences, travel, fancy dinners, concerts. How does a company like Signet compete against a trip to Europe or a Michelin star meal? This feels like a really fundamental shift that could structurally challenge their whole business model.
This is, I think, a really profound and potentially structural headwind for Signet and the whole luxury goods sector, frankly. It raises that important question. How does Signet compete effectively against this documented shift in consumer spending? Away from luxury goods, towards luxury experiences.
It's a real shift.
It is. Multiple studies confirm that when consumers have extra discretionary income, they are increasingly prioritizing these experiences, travel, dining out, entertainment, over tangible luxury products. This experience economy isn't just some indirect competition. It's a direct fight for a share of the consumer's wallet.
So Signet's not just competing with Pandora. They're competing with airlines and hotels, too.
In a very real sense, yes. They're competing for that same discretionary dollar. It reflects a fundamental reprioritization of consumer values, moving away from just owning things towards doing things and creating memories.
So if I'm deciding between, I don't know, a new diamond bracelet and a spontaneous weekend getaway, the getaway might genuinely win out more often these days.
That's increasingly the calculus for many consumers, yes.
And then, of course, there's the significant seasonal aspect of jewelry, too. The holidays must be absolutely massive for them.
They're massively important. That's spot on. The jewelry business is highly seasonal, which creates both big opportunities and significant challenges.
Q4 is everything.
Pretty much. Sales typically peak dramatically during the fourth quarter holiday season, you know, November through December. That period often accounts for a completely disproportionate amount of their annual revenue and profit.
Right.
You get smaller, but still significant uplifts around Valentine's Day in February and Mother's Day in May. But this seasonality creates substantial working capital requirements. They have to build up all that inventory in advance. And it places immense operational pressure on that fourth quarter to deliver strong results. Any misstep in Q4 can dramatically impact the entire year's profitability.
High stakes. Now let's turn our attention specifically to the new consumers coming up. Millennials and Gen Z, they're clearly reshaping the game for a lot of industries. How are their specific preferences remaking the jewelry market, and what does that mean for a traditional player like Signet? They have to pay attention, right?
They absolutely have to. The preferences and the core values of millennial and Gen Z consumers are fundamentally reshaping this market. Signet must adapt, or they genuinely risk becoming obsolete over the long term. These groups now represent the core consumer base for things like bridal jewelry and entry-level fine jewelry purchases. And their priorities are significantly different from previous generations.
I hear so much about them being values-driven consumers. Does that really extend to how they purchase something as traditional as a diamond?
It absolutely does. They demand transparency, ethical sourcing, and sustainability much more explicitly than any previous generation.
It's not just a nice to have for them.
No. For many, it's table stakes. They are highly attuned to the environmental and social impact of their purchases. They actively seek out brands that align with their personal values. This has fueled a huge surge in demand for products with clear, verifiable ethical credentials. Think diamonds that adhere to strict conflict-free sourcing guidelines like the Kimberley process.
Okay.
This isn't just a preference. For many younger consumers, it's basically a non-negotiable requirement before they'll even consider a purchase.
And this is where lab-grown diamonds come roaring into the picture, right? Because they're often positioned as more ethical or sustainable and cheaper.
Precisely. This is exactly where the rise of lab-grown diamonds becomes such a seismic factor. These diamonds are perceived rightly or wrongly, but the perception is key as more eco-friendly and significantly more affordable alternatives to traditional mined diamonds.
And that makes them popular with younger buyers.
Incredibly popular. One survey I saw revealed that a remarkable 72% of Gen Z participants actually expressed a preference for lab-grown diamonds.
72%, that's huge. So, okay, on one hand, this is an undeniable opportunity for Signet, right? They can embrace lab-grown to stay relevant, tap into this growing segment. But on the other hand, doesn't it fundamentally alter the economics of diamonds? Doesn't it create a real strategic tightrope for them?
That is the exact strategic tension Signet is facing right now. While embracing lab-grown diamonds seems essential for maintaining market relevance and attracting these absolutely key demographics, it also poses a significant challenge to their historical profit model.
How so?
Well, it risks commoditizing a product category, diamonds, that has traditionally relied heavily on notions of scarcity, rarity, and the high margins that come with that.
Because lab-grown supply is theoretically unlimited.
Exactly. The potentially unlimited supply of lab-grown diamonds could exert significant long-term downward pressure on pricing and, critically, on profitability for the entire industry, not just Signet.
So they have to sell them, but selling them might hurt their overall profits.
It forces companies like Signet to walk this very fine line between expanding their market reach with these popular new products and potentially eroding the very profit structure they have historically relied on for decades.
Yeah.
It's a major strategic challenge.
Wow. Beyond sustainability and cost, what else do these younger consumers prioritize when it comes to jewelry? Is it still about making these grand, showy gestures, big rocks?
Not nearly as much as maybe it used to be. Younger consumers often view jewelry much more as a form of personal self-expression rather than just a status symbol.
Okay.
They tend to gravitate towards personalized items, think pieces with initials, birthstones, custom engravings, things that tell a unique story or reflect their individuality. The aesthetic often leans more towards minimalism and versatility too. There's a preference for maybe dainty, layerable pieces that can be worn every day, which kind of blurs those traditional lines between special occasion jewelry and everyday wear. They want pieces that really resonate with their identity, not just signify wealth or a relationship status in the old way.
And naturally, being digital natives, their whole purchasing journey is heavily influenced by online channels, social media.
Precisely. These generations grew up online. Their purchasing decisions are heavily influenced by social media platforms, Instagram, TikTok. That's where trends often emerge, where brands build communities.
Right.
They are entirely comfortable making significant purchases online, valuing the convenience, the broad selection, the transparent pricing that e-commerce offers. This just reinforces the absolute necessity of Signet's connected commerce push. They're not excelling online. They're simply not even in the conversation for these crucial consumer groups anymore.
So with all these rapid changes happening, consumer tastes, technology, lab-grown diamonds, who is Signet actually up against in the marketplace today? Is it just other big jewelry stores, or is the competition far more varied than that? And what are the real barriers to truly breaking into this market and succeeding?
The competitive landscape for jewelry retail is intense, and it's incredibly multifaceted. Signet faces pressure from several quite distinct categories.
Okay, like who?
First, you have the traditional jewelers. This includes other national and regional chains, think Pandora, and also those thousands of independent, often family-owned jewelry stores that still make up the bulk of this fragmented market.
Right, the local shops.
Then, very importantly, you have the online pure plays.
Mm-hmm.
These are agile, digitally native companies like Brilliant Earth, which have emerged as really formidable competitors.
Why are they so effective?
Well, these companies often build their entire brand around the values of transparency and sustainability that resonate so strongly with millennials and Gen Z. They often directly challenge Signet's older, more traditional models and messaging. At the higher end, Signet bumps up against luxury and fashion brands. You know, the iconic houses like Tiffany & Co., Cartier, and also fashion brands that have expanded successfully into jewelry. And then, as we already discussed, that growing experience economy represents a powerful form of indirect competition, constantly pulling discretionary spending away from luxury goods altogether.
It's coming from all angles then. So even though it seems relatively easy to set up an online store these days, is it still actually difficult to truly break into the jewelry market and achieve significant scale? What are the real hurdles?
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Well, the barriers to entry for just launching an online jewelry brand might seem relatively low. Anyone can set up a website with Shopify.
Right.
Achieving significant profitable scale is a completely different and much more substantial challenge. The primary hurdles include building genuine brand trust, especially when you're asking people to spend thousands of dollars online for something they haven't touched.
Trust is huge for jewelry.
Huge. Then there's establishing a reliable and genuinely ethical supply chain that meets those modern consumer demands for transparency and sustainability we talked about. That's complex and expensive. And finally, just managing the inherently capital-intensive nature of jewelry inventory. You need a lot of money tied up in stock.
Right.
This is precisely where Signet's immense existing scale and its established infrastructure provide a considerable advantage. They can overcome these barriers far more effectively than almost any nascent player. They have a history, a footprint, and sourcing relationships that are just incredibly hard to replicate from scratch.
Okay, so we've talked about the business itself, the brands, the evolving consumers, the industry dynamics. Now let's really peel back the layers of Signet's financial story. What has their actual performance looked like over, say, the past decade? And what's driving the volatility we've seen in their numbers?
Yeah, it has indeed been a complex and somewhat volatile journey for Signet financially. It directly reflects both that inherent cyclicality of the jewelry industry we discussed and also the impacts of its own ambitious strategic shifts.
Okay.
Revenue, for instance, actually peaked at $7.8 billion back in fiscal 2022 and 2023. That followed a sort of surge in demand post-pandemic when people had stimulus money and couldn't spend on experiences.
Right, the stuff boom.
Exactly. However, more recently, performance has softened quite significantly. Revenue declined to $7.17 billion in fiscal 2024 and then fell further to $6.7 billion in fiscal 2025.
So those are pretty significant declines in the last couple of years. What's primarily driving that pullback? Is it just the economy?
It's largely that, yeah.
Yeah.
This recent downturn reflects mostly a normalization of consumer spending after that period of heightened, kind of unusual demand during the pandemic years.
Yeah.
That's coupled with those persistent inflationary pressures that are just eating into people's discretionary budgets.
Makes sense.
And a key operational indicator, same-store sales, clearly mirrors this trend. It showed declines of 11.6% in fiscal 2024.
Ouch, double digits.
Yeah, and then another 3.4% decline in fiscal 2025. So that signals an undeniable softness in the core business as consumers are clearly tightening their belts.
And what about their margins? With all this revenue pressure and shifting dynamics, lab-grown diamonds potentially pressuring prices. Are their margins holding up?
Well, it's a bit of a mixed picture. Gross margin has actually remained relatively stable and pretty healthy, standing at 39.4% in the trailing 12 months.
That sounds pretty good for retail.
It is, yeah. It suggests they are maintaining decent pricing discipline at the actual product level. However, operating margin has been far more volatile. On a GAAP basis that's generally accepted accounting principles, the operating margin collapsed dramatically, went from 8.7% in fiscal 2024 down to just 1.7% in fiscal 2025.
Wow, from almost 9% to under 2%. That's a huge drop in operating margin. Was that primarily because of the big Blue Nile impairment we talked about earlier?
Precisely. You hit the nail on the head. This dramatic compression was driven almost entirely by that $369.2 million in non-cash impairment charges related to the digital brand acquisitions, predominantly Blue Nile.
So the underlying business margin isn't that bad.
Well, management certainly guides investors to focus on the adjusted operating margin, which excludes those kinds of non-cash charges. And that has been a key target of their whole Path to Brilliance transformation plan, with a stated goal of achieving a sustainable double-digit rate eventually.
Okay.
So, yes, while the underlying operations show maybe a bit more stability when you make that adjustment, the headline GAAP number tells a very, very different story because of that specific, very large accounting charge. It really skews the picture.
And how has all of this impacted the true bottom line, their actual reported profitability and their earnings per share?
Yeah, the impact of those impairment charges is most starkly visible right there in the company's net income. GAAP net income plummeted from a pretty robust $810.4 million in fiscal 2023 down to just $61.2 million in fiscal 2025.
Huge drop.
Massive. Consequently, GAAP diluted earnings per share, or EPS, swung wildly from a positive $15.01 in fiscal 2023 to a loss of $1.81 in fiscal 2025.
A loss per share.
A loss per share on a GAAP basis. This obviously raises that important question. What does this severe decline in reported profitability truly signify for investors, particularly given that huge non-cash component? It dramatically alters the headline numbers investors typically look at first, making any kind of direct year-over-year comparison really difficult.
And things like returns on capital, I imagine that's taken a significant hit too, indicating maybe lower efficiency in using shareholder money.
Yes, exactly. The deterioration in reported profitability has led to a corresponding decline in their returns on capital metrics. Return on equity, or ROE, which measures how efficiently the company generates profit from shareholder investment, has shrunk by a staggering 94% year over year in the most recent period. It fell to just 2.04%, which indicates a really significant reduction in the profitability of the business from an equity holder's perspective, at least on paper. When we look at their 10-year financial summary table, which is in our source materials, you can clearly see these trends playing out. That revenue volatility, the margin pressures, and then that dramatic plunge in net income and EPS in the most recent fiscal year. It paints a picture of a company whose top-line growth is definitely challenged and whose reported profitability is under quite severe strain.
So the GAAP net income looks pretty bleak, right? Yeah. Suggesting a struggling business. But here's the really interesting part, the paradox we hinted at. Signet still seems to be generating a lot of cash. How do we make sense of that stark divergence? This feels like the ultimate battleground for investors trying to figure this company out, doesn't it?
It absolutely is. And it's such a critical point of analysis because it presents this stark contrast that really frames the entire investment debate around Signet. Despite that sharp decline in reported GAAP earnings, Signet's ability to generate cash remains a significant, undeniable strength.
I'll stop.
In fiscal 2025, the company generated $590.9 million in cash just from its operating activities, and over $400 million in free cash flow, that's cash left after capital expenditures.
Even with sales declining.
Even with sales declining. This actually marks the fifth consecutive year of strong cash conversion for them, which is genuinely a testament to the underlying operational efficiency of the business, even when navigating these challenging conditions.
So they're still pulling in real, tangible cash dollars, even though the accounting numbers look rough because of that big non-cash impairment charge affecting net income.
Exactly right. The primary reason for this divergence is that large non-cash impairment charge related to Blue Nile and others. While it significantly reduces reported net income for accounting purposes, hitting those headline EPS numbers hard, it has absolutely no impact on the actual cash produced by the business during that period.
Okay, that's key.
It means that from a liquidity perspective, their ability to fund operations day-to-day, invest for the future, return capital to shareholders, the company is substantially healthier than that headline GAAP EPS number might suggest. Mm-hmm. However, it's a profound paradox. This incredible cash flow is the bull case's shining diamond, right?
Yeah.
It proves the business's underlying resilience and strength. But that impairment charge is the bear's unpolished stone. It's a stark warning sign about where future profits might truly lie.
Because the impairment means management expects lower future cash flows from those assets.
Precisely. It reflects management's own downward revision of the expected future cash flows from those specific assets that were written down. So an investor has to weigh the current strength of the cash flows against the very clear warning signal that the impairment represents for future profitability and the fundamental long-term value of those acquired digital assets. Which story do you believe more?
That really crystallizes the dilemma. Looking forward then, what are the biggest opportunities you see for Signet to potentially reignite growth? And on the flip side, what are the major hurdles still standing in their way?
Okay, on the opportunity side, the significant one is the potential bridal market recovery.
Ah, yes, weddings were delayed.
Exactly. The bridal category accounts for roughly 50% half of Signet's merchandise sales. While it was definitely disrupted by the pandemic and then the subsequent macroeconomic uncertainty, management anticipates a normalization and eventual recovery in engagements and weddings. If that happens, it would provide a significant organic tailwind to their core business.
Half their business. Yeah, that's huge. What else?
Second, there's a strong chance for continued market share consolidation. As the largest and best capitalized player in this very fragmented industry, Signet is exceptionally well positioned to keep gaining share from smaller independent jewelers who just may lack the scale, the marketing budget, or the digital capabilities to compete effectively in this evolving landscape. They can scoop up that business.
Makes sense. Use their scale.
And finally, category expansion. Management has specifically identified the broader fashion jewelry market and also services things like repairs, warranties, maybe even insurance as key growth areas. Signet currently holds only a low single-digit share of the very large fashion jewelry market, so that presents a substantial runway for expansion if they can successfully penetrate it beyond just bridal and basic diamonds.
Okay, so bridal recovery, market share gains, expanding into fashion and services. What about the headwinds? What are the biggest, most persistent challenges that could hamper their trajectory moving forward?
Well, the most immediate and unavoidable headwind is the persistent macroeconomic pressure. That challenging consumer environment, inflation still sticky, higher interest rates may be sticking around, and that broader shift in spending away from discretionary goods that continues to pressure sales and, by extension, profitability. This is a very real, tangible drag on their performance right now.
Can't escape the economy.
Can't escape it. Additionally, there's that intense competitive intensity we talked about. The rise of those agile online competitors, plus a persistently promotional retail environment overall, creates ongoing pressure on both their market share and their pricing power. That could limit any margin expansion, even if sales recover somewhat. This environment forces Signet to really fight tooth and nail for every sale.
So, okay, with all these dynamics in play, the opportunities, the headwinds, the strong cash flow clashing with the challenging GAAP earnings, how is Signet actually deploying its capital? What's their core philosophy when it comes to investing back into the business versus returning cash to shareholders and managing their balance sheet through all this?
Yeah, it's crucial to see where the money is going. Management has been pretty clear in laying out its capital allocation priorities, and their actions over the past few years largely reflect these stated goals.
What are the priorities?
First, they prioritize investing in organic growth to strengthen the core business, you know, store refreshes, technology upgrades. Second, they aim to return excess cash to shareholders. And third, they are committed to maintaining a conservative and strong balance sheet.
Okay, pretty standard goals. Have they followed through?
Their actions over the past 5 years really underscore these priorities. For example, looking at fiscal 2019 through fiscal 2023, the company invested about $750 million in capital projects. But interestingly, they returned $1.4 billion, almost double that, to shareholders through various means, mostly buybacks.
$1.4 billion back to shareholders.
Yeah. During that same period, they also spent nearly $900 million in cash on those two big strategic acquisitions, Diamonds Direct and Blue Nile. And they paid down over $500 million in debt. So it demonstrates a significant focus on both M&A and shareholder returns, all funded by that robust internal cash generation we discussed.
Let's talk a bit more about those acquisitions, specifically their M&A activity. They've had some truly transformational ones in the past, like buying Zale, right? But then there's this recent, very public disappointment with Blue Nile. What does their overall track record tell us about their ability to actually integrate these big purchases and extract the value they expected?
Signet certainly has a history of using M&A transformationally. That $1.4 billion acquisition of Zale Corporation back in 2014 was undeniably a game changer for them. It really solidified their leadership position in the North American market and proved they could handle a large-scale integration successfully.
Okay, so they have done it before.
They have. More recently, though, the strategy seems to have shifted more towards acquiring specific capabilities, particularly in the digital and off-mall spaces, rather than just buying scale. The acquisitions of Diamonds Direct and Blue Nile for that combined total of nearly $900 million in cash were absolutely central to this strategic pivot towards connected commerce and trying to broaden their market reach beyond the traditional mall.
But as we keep coming back to, Blue Nile turned out to be, well, a bit of a mixed bag, to put it mildly. It seems to have cast quite a shadow on that part of their strategy.
It absolutely has. While those acquisitions were clearly intended to expand Signet's addressable market and boost their digital footprint, the subsequent performance, especially of Blue Nile, has been undeniably disappointing. And that's putting it nicely, as evidenced by those massive impairment charges.
Right.
This certainly raises significant questions about the due diligence process they followed, maybe the price they paid for those assets, and ultimately their actual ability to successfully integrate and extract the intended value from these critical digital businesses. It makes their recent M&A integration track record look decidedly mixed, despite that earlier success they had with Zale. It's a blemish.
Definitely. Beyond acquisitions, though, they've also been incredibly aggressive with share repurchases and dividends lately. It seems like returning capital directly to shareholders is a monumental priority for them right now.
It has absolutely been a cornerstone of their financial strategy recently, signaling confidence or trying to signal confidence and a clear commitment to shareholders. Signet has been particularly aggressive with its share repurchase program.
How aggressive?
In fiscal 2025 alone, they returned approximately $1 billion to shareholders. That included redeeming some convertible preferred shares, but also significant common share repurchases. This level of activity led to a nearly 20% reduction in their diluted share count in just a single year.
20% reduction in shares? That's huge. So it sounds like a good thing for existing shareholders, right? Because it should automatically boost earnings per share, all else being equal.
It does, mathematically.
But in a period where revenue is declining and reported profitability is challenged, how do we differentiate between genuine operational strength driving that EPS number and what might be seen more as a financial engineering effect coming purely from the buybacks?
That is such a crucial distinction for any investor to make here. While these buybacks are undeniably accretive to earnings per share, meaning they mechanically boost the EPS number simply by reducing the number of shares outstanding, their sheer scale, relative to the company's market capitalization, suggests that they are becoming a primary driver of per-share earnings growth right now.
So it might be masking weakness.
Potentially. An investor has to carefully dissect that EPS growth number to distinguish between genuine operational improvement, like increasing sales or improving underlying margins, and the purely financial effects of a shrinking share base. While buybacks are generally seen as shareholder-friendly, they can sometimes mask underlying operational softness if they're not paired with strong, growing business fundamentals. It's something to watch closely.
And they're also committed to paying dividends as well, I understand, not just buybacks.
Yes, that's right. In addition to the aggressive buybacks, the company has explicitly committed to being a dividend growth company. They increased their quarterly common dividend to $0.23 per share back in early 2023. So this dual approach to capital return buybacks, plus a growing dividend, aims to satisfy both growth-oriented and income-oriented investors in their shareholder base.
Okay, so they're investing some in acquisitions, giving a lot of cash back to shareholders. What about capital expenditures for the business itself? Are they still investing enough internally? And how robust is their balance sheet overall to support all these strategic shifts and potential headwinds?
Capital expenditures, or CapEx, are strategically focused on investments in technology, digital capabilities, and store modernization things that directly align with their connected commerce vision.
Seems appropriate. How much are they spending?
Planned CapEx for fiscal 2026 is guided to be in the range of $145 million to $160 million, which is, you know, a disciplined level of investment. It reflects their focus on operational efficiency and cost control while still trying to innovate where it matters most for their strategy.
And the balance sheet. Is it strong enough to handle all these ongoing transformations and potential economic bumps in the road?
This is actually a key positive story for them. They made really significant strides in strengthening their balance sheet over the past few years.
How so?
Over the past 5 years, the company has actively paid down a lot of debt. They reduced their leverage ratio, a measure of debt relative to earnings, from a high of about 4 times EBITDA down to a much more conservative 2 times.
That's a big improvement.
It is. And by early fiscal 2025, the company reported a remarkably strong financial position overall. $604 million in cash sitting on the books, and notably, no actual debt outstanding.
No debt. Wow.
No debt. This is a considerable achievement that provides them with a strong financial cushion and a lot of flexibility to navigate uncertainty or pounce on opportunities. If you look at Table 2 in our source materials, it clearly summarizes their capital allocation over the past 5 fiscal years, and you can see that heavy lean into the share repurchases alongside that significant debt reduction.
That's impressive deleveraging. Finally, let's talk about leadership. Management is key in these situations. What's the track record of the previous CEO and who's steering the ship now, trying to guide Signet through these, frankly, turbulent waters?
Right. Leadership is critical. Virginia Gina Drosos served as CEO from August 2017 up until 2024. She inherited a company that was facing some significant operational challenges and a sales slump at the time.
So she came in during a tough period.
She did. Drosos, who is a seasoned veteran from Procter & Gamble, initiated a comprehensive turnaround strategy known as the Path to Brilliance back in 2018. This was a 3-year plan focused very intensely on cost savings, optimizing that store footprint we discussed, and making significant investments in building out their connected commerce digital platform. This was then followed by a strategy called Inspiring Brilliance, which was aimed more at driving sustainable growth.
And what were her key achievements during that time, and maybe the major challenges that still remained when she left?
Well, under her leadership, the company definitely successfully stabilized its operations. They significantly strengthened the balance sheet by paying down all that debt we just mentioned. And they returned substantial capital to shareholders. Those were undeniable operational and financial wins.
Sounds pretty good.
However, the strategy hadn't yet fully translated into sustainable top-line revenue growth. And, of course, those costly acquisitions of the digital brands, specifically Blue Nile, led to those significant write-downs, which somewhat temper an otherwise strong track record of operational improvement and balance sheet fortification. Growth remained elusive.
Okay, so new leadership took the helm recently. Who's in charge now, and what's their background? What's their vision for tackling these complex challenges?
In 2024, J.K. Simoncic was appointed as the new CEO. His background includes over 30 years in retail, most notably serving as the CEO of Academy Sports plus Outdoors.
Ah, Academy Sports. Okay.
Right. There, he led a successful turnaround that involved refining their merchandise strategy and preparing the company for its IPO. So his extensive experience in large-scale retail transformation and navigating shifting consumer trends seems directly relevant to the complex challenges and the significant opportunities facing Signet today.
Seems like a good fit on paper. And what's the strategic vision for him and his team going forward, particularly with this Grow Brand Love initiative we touched on earlier?
The company's current strategic framework is indeed branded as Grow Brand Love. This really represents an evolution from the more operational focus of Path to Brilliance under Drosos towards a more brand-centric approach now.
What does brand-centric mean in practice?
Well, the goal seems to be moving beyond just operating a portfolio of store banners and instead trying to build distinct, emotionally resonant brands, Kay, Zales, Jared, Blue Nile, that can foster deeper customer loyalty and, crucially, reduce that internal cannibalization risk we talked about.
Okay. And what are the key pillars?
The key pillars of this longer-term strategy include winning in the bridal market, still core, expanding in accessible luxury and services, gaining more share in fashion jewelry, and leading in digital by continuing to invest in and optimize that connected commerce model.
It sounds comprehensive on paper, certainly hits all the right notes, but given the massive headwinds we've discussed, the economy, changing tastes, lab-grown diamonds, is this strategy truly sufficient to propel Signet forward? What's the biggest test, you think, for this new leadership team?
That really is the central question for investors, and obviously for the new leadership team itself. Whether this strategic vision, however well articulated, is robust enough to overcome those powerful secular headwinds facing the entire industry, and critically, how well can they actually execute it?
Execution is key.
Always. The significant impairment of the digital acquisitions represents a notable and very costly failure in execution and capital allocation under the previous leadership. The new team will be under immense pressure to demonstrate improved performance in integrating and growing these critical digital assets, turning them from what looks like a liability right now into a true growth engine for the future. Their ability to deliver consistent top-line growth while maintaining healthy margins in this very challenging environment will be the ultimate measure of their success. That's the job.
Okay, we've covered the company inside and out, the industry, the consumer, the management strategy. Now let's get right down to the brass tacks. How does the market actually value Signet Jewelers right now? What are the multiples telling us? And what does that tell us about whether it's potentially a deep value opportunity, you know, that diamond waiting to shine, or if it's fundamentally a classic value trap looking attractive on the surface, but maybe fundamentally flawed underneath?
Right. The valuation piece is where it all comes together or falls apart, depending on your view. Signet's current valuation presents a really stark contrast, depending on which specific metric you choose to look at. And that reflects the market's deep uncertainty about its future prospects.
How so? What's the contrast?
Well, metrics based on the company's recently depressed GAAP earnings, the ones hit by the impairment, suggest the stock is prohibitively expensive, almost uninvestable on that basis alone. Conversely, metrics based on its strong cash flow, or maybe its underlying asset base, suggest it might actually be significantly undervalued. This dichotomy really frames the central valuation question, and it's where the investment debate truly heats up.
Okay, let's break that down. Let's start with the classic price-to-earnings, or P-E ratio. What does that tell us in this specific context?
Well, because of that dramatic collapse in GAAP earnings, driven almost entirely by those substantial non-cash impairment charges, the trailing P-E ratio for Signet is currently inflated way up over 90 times earnings.
90? Wow, that's nosebleed territory.
It is. This metric is severely distorted and, frankly, not useful for any meaningful valuation purposes right now. A forward PE based on analyst estimates of future, hopefully normalized earnings would be a more appropriate measure to look at. But the trailing number is essentially meaningless in this particular context because of that huge one-time accounting hit.
Okay, so PE is out, at least the trailing one for now.
Mm.
What about price to sales? Or PS, that looks at valuation relative to revenue.
Right. The price to sales or PS ratio currently stands at approximately 0.5x sales.
0.5x, that seems low for a retailer, doesn't it?
It is very low, yes. And it generally indicates significant market pessimism regarding the company's ability to generate future profits from its current sales base. It suggests the market isn't willing to pay much for each dollar of revenue Signet generates, likely reflecting caution about their future growth trajectory and maybe their long-term margin potential.
Okay, so PE looks crazy high, PS looks really low. Are there any other maybe more stable multiples we can look at that aren't quite as skewed by those big non-cash charges?
Absolutely. A common one to use in situations like this is the enterprise value to EBITDA, or EBITDA multiple, that currently sits around 7.5x for Signet.
And why is that more stable?
It's generally a more stable metric than PE because EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, excludes many of those non-cash charges, like the impairment, and also ignores financing and tax effects. So it gives a somewhat clearer, albeit still incomplete, picture of its operational valuation relative to its cash flow generation before some of those other factors kick in.
Mm.
7.5x is, you know, not obviously cheap or expensive on its own. Depends on the industry and growth.
Okay. And what about cash flow itself? We've talked extensively about their strong cash generation. Does that strength actually show up clearly in the valuation metrics? Is there a cash flow multiple we can look at?
This is truly where the story becomes most compelling for potential investors, for the bulls anyway. Perhaps the most attractive valuation metric for Signet right now is its free cash flow, or FCF, yield. That currently stands at a very attractive
11.4%. 11.4% FCF yield. That's high.
It is very high. This high yield directly reflects the company's strong and consistent cash generation, which, as we've discussed repeatedly, is not fully captured by that distorted GAAP earnings figure.
Yeah.
It suggests that for every dollar you invest in the stock at the current price, you're getting a very healthy return in actual cold, hard cash generated by the business each year.
So let me try and simplify this core tension. You're basically saying that if an investor believes that huge impairment charge is genuinely a one-time event, maybe a kitchen sinking exercise by new management, then the stock looks incredibly cheap based on its underlying cash flow, that 11.4% yield.
That's the bull argument, yes.
But if you think that impairment is actually a signal of deeper, more permanent problems, maybe the digital acquisitions are fundamentally flawed, competition is just too intense, then that very low price-to-sales ratio of 0.5x is probably justified, and the stock might actually be a value trap.
You have encapsulated the absolute core of the investment debate perfectly. The ultimate question for any potential investor really lies in how you interpret this divergence. If you believe the impairment is largely a one-time, non-recurring event, and that the company's underlying cash-generating ability remains intact and sustainable, then yes, that high FCF yield strongly suggests the stock is deeply undervalued. It's the shining diamond argument for the bull case.
Okay.
Conversely, if you believe the impairment is a clear signal of a permanent deterioration in the business's long-term earning power or its competitive position in this changing market, then the low PS ratio is justified, and the stock may indeed be a classic value trap, a company that appears cheap on certain metrics but whose fundamentals are actually in secular decline. That's the unpolished, maybe flawed stone argument of the bear case.
Got it. That makes the dilemma very clear. To give us some broader context here, how does Signet actually stack up against its competitors on these various valuation metrics? What does a peer group comparison reveal about its relative attractiveness or maybe its challenges?
Yeah, context is crucial. You can't value a company in isolation. So to provide that essential context, we compare Signet against a carefully selected peer group of other publicly traded jewelry and accessible luxury retailers.
Who's in the peer group?
It includes direct competitors like Pandora and Brilliant Earth, and also some broader specialty retailers like Tapestry, that's Coach and Kate Spade, and Capri Holdings, which owns Michael Kors and Versace, plus Movado Group. When we look at Table 3 in the source docs, which meticulously details this peer comparison across various metrics, several key points emerge that really shed light on Signet's relative positioning.
Okay, what are the most striking takeaways when you analyze that comparison table? Does Signet look cheap or expensive compared to them?
Well, what stands out immediately is that Signet trades at a significant discount to Pandora, particularly on a price-to-sales basis.
Okay, cheaper than Pandora. Why?
This discount, however, is generally seen by the market as justified. It reflects Pandora's superior recent growth profile, its higher gross margins, and its stronger operating margins. Essentially, the market perceives Pandora as a higher quality, more consistent growth business right now.
Makes sense. What about the others?
Compared to other specialty retailers like Tapestry or Capri, Signet's overall valuation appears quite low on most metrics. But, crucially, its own operational metrics, like its recent negative revenue growth and lower profitability, are also generally weaker than many of its more successful peers in that broader group.
So it's cheap, but maybe for a reason?
That seems to be the market's view. Interestingly, Brilliant Earth, another competitor focused on ethical sourcing and online sales, actually has an even lower PS ratio than Signet right now. That likely reflects its current lack of sustained profitability and its smaller overall scale compared to Signet. So the conclusion from the peer analysis is that while Signet appears inexpensive on a surface level, especially on cash flow, its discount seems at least partially warranted by its recent negative growth trends and lower reported profitability compared to many best-in-class peers. The market is clearly pricing in the challenges and uncertainties we've been discussing.
Okay. Beyond just looking at these standard multiples like PE, PS, EBITDA, what else should an astute investor consider when trying to arrive at a really comprehensive valuation for Signet? Are there some more advanced approaches that might give better insight here?
Absolutely. Standard multiples only tell part of the story, especially for a company in transition like Signet. Several other factors are crucial for a more nuanced valuation.
Like what?
First, cyclical normalization. Given the inherent cyclicality of the jewelry industry that we keep mentioning, a valuation based solely on a single year's earnings or cash flows, especially a volatile year like the last one, can be highly misleading. A much more accurate approach would involve trying to normalize earnings or cash flows over a full economic cycle.
How do you do that?
You might look at average performance over, say, the last 5 or 7 years to smooth out those cyclical peaks and troughs, arriving at a more sustainable measure of the company's true underlying earning power.
Okay, normalize the cycle. What else?
Second, a sum of the parts, SOTP analysis, could be very valuable here, given Signet's multi-banner structure and the differing profiles of its assets.
Break it down by brand.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
This would involve assigning separate valuations to Signet's different business units. For example, you might value the stable, cash-generating North American brick-and-mortar business using a steady cash flow multiple. Then you'd assign a separate, maybe growth-oriented, or perhaps in Blue Nile's case, a distressed valuation to its digital assets like Blue Nile and James Allen. This helps break down the complexity and avoids valuing everything with the same brush.
That makes sense. Yeah. Anything else?
Finally, asset-based valuation also provides some useful perspective, particularly on the downside risk. The company holds significant value in its inventory, billions of dollars worth, and it has substantial real estate assets, even if some are leases. This tangible book value can offer some degree of downside support to the stock price, even if earnings remain volatile. It acts as a sort of floor, if you will, below which the value of the assets themselves provide some measure of protection for investors.
Okay, so we've laid out the valuation picture, the complexities, the bull and bear arguments rooted in those numbers, but every investment carries risk, obviously. As Signet attempts to navigate this incredibly complex and evolving landscape, what are the absolute core risks and strategic challenges that could potentially derail its future performance and its valuation? What keeps bears up at night?
Yeah. Despite its market leadership and strong balance sheet, Signet faces a really formidable array of risks and challenges that could significantly impact its future. These risks are, as we've touched on, both cyclical, tied to the broader macroeconomic environment, and secular, related to those long-term fundamental shifts in the industry and consumer behavior.
Let's start with the cyclical ones, macroeconomy.
Right. The first is that undeniable macroeconomic sensitivity. As a retailer selling high-ticket discretionary goods, Signet's performance is just intrinsically linked to the health of the consumer. Factors like persistent inflation, rising interest rates, unemployment worries, declining consumer confidence, all of these can lead to a significant pullback in spending on items like jewelry, directly impacting their revenue and profitability. The recent sales declines are a clear manifestation of this ongoing risk. It's just hard to fight the tide.
Right. And then the really big one, maybe the most significant long-term threat. Those fundamental shifts in what consumers actually want, particularly the younger generations moving away from traditional diamonds, wanting sustainability, this seems like it could undermine Signet's entire historical business model.
It absolutely is, I think, the most profound long-term challenge. The secular shifts in consumer preferences represent a fundamental threat. That profound move away from traditional mined diamonds towards lab-grown alternatives. The increasing demand for demonstrable sustainability and ethical sourcing, and that broader pivot from buying luxury goods to buying luxury experiences, all of these represent fundamental structural challenges to Signet's historical business model, which was built largely on selling mined diamonds through mall stores. These trends genuinely challenge that model at its core, potentially leading to a permanent loss of market share and relevance if they fail to adapt effectively and quickly enough. This isn't just a temporary bump in the road. It feels more like a reshaping of the entire landscape they operate in.
A seismic shift. And then there's all that competition, especially from the agile online players, keeping the pressure on margins and constantly trying to steal market share.
Exactly. The intense competitive environment in the jeweler market means Signet faces relentless pressure from those agile and digitally native online retailers. They're often better positioned, frankly, to appeal to younger demographics with their lower overhead structures, targeted digital marketing, and brand messaging built around values.
Right.
This intense competition, coupled with the inherent price transparency the internet provides, creates a highly promotional environment that puts significant downward pressure on gross margins, making it harder for Signet to maintain profitability without resorting to heavy discounts, which further erodes margins. It's a tough cycle.
And managing all that inventory must be tricky too, especially with trends changing so fast.
Definitely. Inventory management risk is significant. Jewelry retail is inherently inventory intensive. It requires a huge amount of capital to be tied up in stock. Misjudging fashion trends or shifts in consumer demand, for instance, getting the balance wrong between lab-grown and mined diamond inventory can lead to a rapid accumulation of obsolete stock.
And then you have to mark it down heavily.
Exactly. That excess inventory then requires heavy markdowns just to clear it out, which severely impacts gross margins and overall profitability. It's a constant high-stakes balancing act for their merchandising teams.
And their huge physical footprint, particularly all those stores still in malls, sounds like it could be both an asset and a liability in this changing retail landscape.
It's precisely that duality. The real estate footprint optimization is a constant, costly challenge. A substantial portion of Signet's store base is still located in traditional shopping malls, a retail format that, as we know, has been experiencing a secular decline in foot traffic for years now.
Not getting better.
Doesn't seem to be. While the company is actively working to optimize its portfolio closing underperforming mall stores, opening more off-mall locations, this is a costly, complex, and very long-term process. It drains capital and management attention. A large, somewhat inflexible physical real estate footprint remains a key operational challenge and a potential drag on resources if it's not managed absolutely perfectly.
And finally, what about the sustainability of their margins? They've improved them on an adjusted basis, but can they hold on to those gains?
That's the margin sustainability risk. While management has successfully improved those adjusted operating margins through their various transformation plans and cost cutting, the sustainability of these higher margins is a key risk going forward. The improvements have been driven in large part by diligent cost-cutting initiatives and creating a more efficient operating model. That's great. But sustained competitive pressure, especially from those online players and maybe even from within their own brand portfolio, may force the company to increase promotional activity again just to drive traffic and sales. And that could easily erode these hard-won margin gains. It's hard to cut costs forever if revenue isn't growing.
Okay, so after diving deep into all of this, the business, the market, the finances, the risks, what's the core investment thesis here? Let's try to boil it down. Is Signet Jewelers truly a deep value opportunity waiting for its moment to shine again? Or is it fundamentally a value trap, a seemingly cheap stock that just keeps getting cheaper for good reasons? Let's break down the bull case versus the bear case one last time.
Okay, the bull case. The argument for Signet as a deep value play is rooted firmly in its undeniable market leadership and its significant scale advantages. Proponents argue that Signet is the undisputed leader in a large, still fragmented market, possessing scale advantages in sourcing, marketing, and brand recognition that are incredibly difficult for anyone else to replicate.
Okay, leadership and scale.
Right. The company has undergone a successful operational turnaround, resulting in that much stronger, fortified balance sheet with no debt, and a highly efficient operating model that generates substantial and consistent free cash flow, even in tough times.
The cash flow is key for bulls.
Absolutely. This strong cash flow provides a significant margin of safety for investors. It fuels that very aggressive shareholder return program through both buybacks and dividends, and it allows for continued investment in strategic priorities. If management can successfully execute its strategy to capture that expected recovery in the bridal market and continue to gain market share from weaker competitors, then the stock appears deeply undervalued, particularly when you measure it by that robust free cash flow yield. It's essentially a bet on resilience, market power, and eventual cyclical recovery.
Okay, that's the bull case. Strong cash flow, market leader, balance sheet strength, potential recovery. Now, the flip side, the bear case. Why would someone stay away from Signet, viewing it as a potential value trap, despite those points?
The bearish argument centers squarely on those formidable secular headwinds we've discussed, and significant questions surrounding strategic execution, particularly regarding the digital acquisitions. Bears argue that the core traditional diamond jewelry market is being fundamentally challenged, maybe even disrupted, by the shifting preferences of younger consumers.
Lab-grown sustainability experiences.
Exactly. Those younger consumers increasingly favor lab-grown diamonds, they prioritize sustainability and transparency, and they are demonstrably opting for experiences over goods when spending discretionary income. These powerful long-term trends, bears argue, could permanently impair the entire industry's historical pricing power and margin structure, hitting Signet particularly hard given its legacy business.
So the core business is shrinking structurally.
That's the fear. Furthermore, the company's recent strategic acquisitions in the digital space, as starkly highlighted by those massive write-downs on Blue Nile, raise serious concerns about management's capital allocation discipline and, maybe more importantly, its actual ability to compete effectively against more agile, digitally native online players.
Right.
In this view, Signet's low valuation multiples, that low PS ratio, for example, are not a sign of a bargain opportunity. Instead, they are seen as a reflection of a business potentially in secular decline. That makes it a potential value trap, a seemingly cheap company whose fundamentals are actually deteriorating underneath the surface. It's basically a bet that the structural changes are too powerful to overcome. #outrobatra.
So we've journeyed through the intricate, certainly dazzling and maybe sometimes perplexing world of Signet Jewelers, from its truly unparalleled market dominance and that complex multi-banner strategy, to the profound shifts in consumer preferences for things like lab-grown diamonds and sustainability, and then onto its complex, often contradictory financial picture. We've really seen that fascinating tension between its strong, consistent free cash flow generation, which is undeniable, and the struggling reported GAAP earnings, which were marred by those significant impairment charges from the acquisitions.
It's a really compelling case study, isn't it? A company navigating a deeply traditional industry right in the middle of fundamental rapid shifts in both consumer behavior and technology. The whole debate between it being a potential deep value opportunity or a challenging value trap really seems to hinge on how successfully they can adapt to these powerful headwinds, and crucially, execute their ambitious transformation plans, proving that they are not just reacting to change, but maybe truly leading through it.
So what does this all mean for you, listening in? As you reflect on a company like Signet Jewelers, maybe consider how companies in other traditional established industries adapt or sometimes fail to adapt to these kinds of fundamental consumer and technological shifts.
Yeah, think about other sectors facing similar dilemmas.
Right, where a company's past success, its very foundation, might actually become a hindrance for its future success. What stands out to you about how a company like Signet tries to balance tradition with innovation, particularly when the very definition of value in their core product, the diamond, is being fundamentally challenged?
It really boils down to a question of resilience, foresight, and ultimately a company's ability to truly reinvent itself or at least significantly evolve when faced with potentially seismic change.
We certainly hope this deep dive has given you a clearer, maybe more nuanced picture of the complexities, the risks, and the opportunities surrounding Signet Jewelers. Thanks for joining us.